So anyway, my name is Damon, and I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is August the 10th of 2004. And I'm going to start out at the end, because there was a guy who came into our group conscience. He wasn't part of our group, but he suggested that we make a measure about adding something to the end of what we do every day, and it was this: "And finally, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the principle of anonymity has an immense spiritual significance. It reminds us that we are to place principles before personalities, that we're actually to practice a genuine humility. This to the end, that our great blessings may never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of Him who presides over us all." And I got to thinking about, what are those great blessings? And also, what is spoil? You know, what's a spoiled kid? One who gets everything and it's not enough. Right? Can't be satisfied. And doesn't that fit the alcoholic? Did you ever have enough? Oh, no, and then it's too much. No, it's too, you know. You know, and this idea that we rate very highly on a perfectionist scale. Well, I think what I want to do is I want to make sure I qualify for AA and disqualify myself for sainthood all at the same time. I think we call it the actual, you know, what it was like. And I think I can do that both in one. And then I'd like to cover what, in looking at this and going back through the various things that I think are my great blessings, and I think are possibly our great blessings. So that's my idea. I don't know if I'll accomplish it or not, but let's see. Anyway, I was born in Atlanta in 1955. I'm 62 years old. Spent first few years down in East Point, and in 64 we moved up to Marietta into a new neighborhood. I started having trouble at the elementary school. I don't know if they talk about Ritalin today, and I got Paddling back then. Anybody else remembers the Paddling? Yeah. So my parents took me to a child psychologist, and they said, "Well, he's bored." Now, you know, I come from a very, very loving family, two older sisters, you know, and parents who just really loved each other. And so I got really no bloody excuse for being an alcoholic and acting the way I did. I really don't. And I think what I love about AA is we throw out the why in this place. You know, if you want to know why you're doing what you're doing, I guess go see a psychiatrist or psychologist. They're pretty good at that, or a preacher. You know, I think, and we need that. But I thank God that this is a place where we just talk about how it works, not why I got in here. Each and every one of us in this room came in and drank for a different reason. But we have a solution. Isn't that great? It's like tube socks. You know? One size fits all. So, back when I was 6 years old, I had a pull your pants down club with a girl down the street, and we were the only two members. Did anybody else here get pleasure by sneaking around? Can I, you know, right? I see a few honest people out there. But, you know, that was a lot of my M.O. And I was at this, my parents, who, you know, middle class, but they just barely could afford, but they sent me to a private school. It was interesting, at that private school, I was sort of the bottom of the rung, you know, I was bullied there, And yet at the neighborhood I was at, I was the ringleader. We had a three-story tree hut. And actually had a spinner on the top for spin the bottle. I don't think we ever used it for that, but we were hopeful. So, but I had this kind of dichotomy. You know, they say the alcoholic leads a double life, you know, and I had that. Now, I grew up in the 60s. I sniffed glue when I was 8 years old. My sister turned me on to marijuana at 10 as a step up. And at 12 years old, we went and mixed the clear stuff and put it in a Sprite bottle, and mixed the colored liquor and put it in a Coke bottle, and went out and drank it all so we wouldn't get in trouble. Of course, we all got sick. My sister found us at the house, cleaned up after it. My mom came home, and they said I had the flu, and I got the day off from school the next day. So, You know, this is there was this idea about drinking as being fun, and then fun with consequences, and then consequences, right? And that's a lot of it. I grew up in the 60s. I used to hitchhike down to Piedmont Park down in Atlanta, take my guitar down and sell joints out of my guitar, you know. $1 a piece back then. I hear inflation has struck in that area. The hippies down there, there was a guy down there who lived in an apartment around there, and I helped him make candles, and we sold them in the park, and, you know. But it was also a time of seeking. I think a lot of that was just seeking. And I think a lot of the people who come into AA and stay in AA are seekers, you know. It's not just that we're alcoholics. There's a lot of different ways to do that, but we're seeking something. And I remember one of those hippies when I was 15 years old, he said, is it a coincidence you're a Christian in a Christian country? If it's the truth of the universe, why does it matter where you're born? I thought, well, that's interesting. If I was born in Saudi Arabia, you know, I'd be Islam, you know. If I was born in India, I'd be Hindu or Sikh or Muslim or Buddhist or, you know, quite a few others. And I, you know, if you're looking for truth, I said, well, maybe I should look around and then just sort of see. And I began to explore some. I'm one of those, I got C average in that private school. And it was really because I didn't apply myself. Did anybody else been told you had a lot of potential if you only applied yourself? Yeah. Well, my parents ran away from home when I was 17. I was the baby. So they'd always want to live on a lake. My dad traveled an area that centered somewhere around Auburn University there. So they moved to a lake down there and invited me to come down. I said, that's a town of 2,000. I'm a city boy, you know. So I moved down to 12th Street between Peachtree and West Peachtree, and I got a job working at Blue Cross Blue Shield in their mailroom. And I had the greatest title I've ever had. I was the chief inserter. I was running a six-station Phillipsburg inserting machine. Now, this talks a little bit about, because I had a temporary job shredding insurance documents, and I just had been given a good work ethic, and I just blew through them faster than they thought, and they gave me a permanent job there at 17 years old. But as I worked that year, I began to realize, living in downtown Atlanta and all that, that getting a college education may not be such a bad idea. And so I went and made that decision. The willingness came in. And this will come in again, willingness. I was given the gift of willingness. And I went to a junior college there in Alabama because I didn't qualify for Auburn in that area just because my grades were so poor. And it was kind of an extension of Alabama high schools, really. But I applied myself, and I got a 4.0 there, and started taking history, and because I really wanted to study, you know, history from around the world, learn more about these cultures. And finished up there, and my parents said, well, you can pretty well go where you want to, and I wanted to go for higher education, so I called up Colorado, and because I like the mountains, and I wanted to go for higher education. And I called up the long-distance operator, and I said, what colleges do you have up here? And this was back when you called them. You didn't Google back then. And they said Colorado and Colorado State. And I said, hold on. And I pulled a penny out of my pocket, and I flipped it, and it was tails, and I went to Colorado State. That was my planning for higher education. But as it turned out, and this is those things that have happened in each and all of our lives, they had a very good Eastern Studies. I actually took a year of Chinese language there. But on the first week I was up there, I went to hand out refrigerators, you know, for the dorms. It was during the summer. And I came down and sat down on the couch next to these two ladies who were talking. And you guys will find this hard to believe, but I butted into the conversation. Some people here know me. And one of those ladies, we're now married 38 years, so... But I like the guy said, we never decided to divorce each other at the same time. I've been very, really, well, before we got married, we said divorce is no option. And this is no slight on anybody that's had divorce or anything. I'm just very blessed that to have found someone. And let me tell you, through my drinking days, I really have benefited from that a lot. I think she's just stubborn. She didn't want to admit she made a mistake when she married me. I think. It's been an amazing journey, and I am a man most richly blessed. But you know, I quit smoking weed, and the circle kind of disappeared. I wasn't really drinking or using, you know, addictively at all during the 80s. I finished up there. I didn't finish up at Colorado State. I actually took a year off, a little over a year, and I worked at a nursing home. And I saw people married 75 years. I saw people 105 years old, 94 years old, and I saw them looking back on life. And I learned some amazing life lessons there because I learned what was important. I saw some families come in and handle their elderly parents well. And I saw some come in and not do it so well. And just a lot of really good life lessons. And it pretty much carried me through the 80s. After we got married, we came back here to Atlanta because my wife really liked all the plants and how everything grew down here. And also that was in her industry. She's an occupational therapist. And so we came back here and she got a job and I reestablished residency and went to Georgia State and finished up my undergraduate degree. And I was going to go do an international business degree to go along with it. And the marketing department was on the same floor as the international business department, and I had taken two courses in computer programming. And I found out that my history degree was an excellent background for computer programming because, really, programming is the history of data moving through a system. It's concepts. It's not really math. So I wound up doing a lot of things with computers. This was back in 81, 82. And I was around when the first PC I got was, I got a job working for Equifax right out of through the marketing department. It was in their marketing research division. And I remember my boss, who was a man of few words, I saw a box sitting underneath a table said IBM, but we were an HP shop. I said, "What's that?" He said, "Computer." I said, "What you going to do with it?" He said, "Don't know." See, I know that the home office was IBM shop. And so I knew all this stuff. He didn't have to tell me much more. I said, "Can I play with it?" He said, "Go right ahead." And that was my exposure to an IBM XT with a 10 megabyte hard drive that was this big. And it had been upped to 640K of memory. You know, look at it today. So I guess on my resume I could say I'm capable of conversing with inanimate objects. And I went up through Equifax, became a data center manager there. I got my master's degree in marketing research, which had a lot of quantitative methods and statistics, and so I was supervising the people that did the statistics as well. Then I got a job. A friend who was doing scouts with the kids worked at HP, and I got a job working for them. Well, sometime in all of this transition, I went from being an optimist and looking at what was right and what was good about life and being in wonder and exploring to looking at what was wrong with my life, what was wrong with my wife, what was wrong with my job. And in the varieties of religious experience, William James says one of the traits and the signs and experiences of someone having a religious experience is a shift from pessimism to optimism. And I did the reverse. And this one of the guys who worked for me when I was still at Equifax, he had a bachelor party. They went to a belly dancing thing, and then they went to a strip joint. And I was just going to be camaraderie with the guys, and then it was a pull-your-pants-down club. And I thought, well, I'm not getting this at home. And then I went to go get a massage, thinking I would get just a massage, and the lady offered the full treatment, and I took her up on it. But the guilt started kicking in. Because Mama raised me better than that. And I rationalized and justified it. You know, I said, well, in China and Japan, they have concubines, you know, which relieves the sexual pressure off of the wife. Well, this is about delusion, not denial. Delusion, I'm not in China or Japan. My wife is neither Chinese nor Japanese. And I ain't about to tell her, you know, because I get pleasure by sneaking around. But I started going to the strip joints and I started drinking, but all of a sudden, One morning, driving into work, I was going to have to do a show because I was working at HP and show off some computer equipment, and I had the shakes. So I drank. There was a little bit left in the bottle, and that started the morning drink. And I was working with this shop as 24/7 because we were doing outsourcing, so I could come and go, and everybody ever knew, really. Well, one time, one of those clients smelled my breath while around their millions of dollars worth of equipment and reported me. Of course, I denied it. That was April of 2001, and I quit drinking. You know, but I put on the afterburners. I think we've done that before, you know, and I got accolades and things were happening, you know, and I was showing up and I was on fire. And then the CEO, as a money-saving thing, laid off everybody in the company who was on probation, even though I was about to be pulled off. And a lot of people were very surprised because I got pleasured by sneaking around. They didn't know what I was doing either. And I was a lone drinker. I drank, went down to a tennis court that was down near the building, parked, kind of snuck in there, and I'd drink vodka and listen to, because you can't smell vodka, right? And listen to G. Gordon Liddy and Neil Bortz and sit there and drink. Yeah, I was not the life of the party. I was the party. I wasn't. So I remember as I was leaving that place that I felt this gigantic hole in me, and I realized I had lent my identity to that whole job, and that whole career, and everything. And I still wasn't drinking. 9/11 came shortly after that. I was in Birmingham. But see, I remember telling these people, by the way, when I left, I said, I'm going to be a millionaire when I get back here. In a year from now, you just watch. Well, today I'm a millionaire many times over in an entirely different currency. See, because I didn't want the car. I wanted the quality of life I thought I would get when I got the car. You know, I didn't want the job. I wanted the quality of life that I would have when I got the job. So 9/11 hits, and I know my industry has changed. And I hold off for about 2 days, and my sister and brother-in-law go to a German club, and I don't want to drink. But they're off, and I know where the blackjack is. You ever had it call you? So I was going to have one drink. I had three. Now, I'm not the guy who drinks the whole bottle because I don't want to get caught. But the next morning at 9 o'clock, I'm sitting in the parking lot waiting for the liquor store to open. And it doesn't open until 9:30. Tell you what, folks. If I keep doing what I'm doing right now, I won't ever have to be sitting there waiting for the liquor store to open ever again. Life is in session. Are you present? I had checked out. Well, anyway, I started a series from 2001 into 2003. I was at the jail meeting at the work release, and the guy said, boy, I'll tell you what, you guys really sold me. When I get out of here, I'm going to quit drinking and using. And I said, for God's sake, don't quit. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, quitting doesn't work. How many times have you quit? I told him, this is a program for starters, not for quitters. I got to start being a good husband. Start being a good father. When I look down at the list of what a good father does, drinking's not on the list. And there's a big difference between not being on the list and quitting. Because when I'm quitting, it's still on the list. And I don't know, I've seen that transition happen in a number of the faces I'm looking at here. And it's a beautiful thing. Well, anyway, comes Thanksgiving of 2003, and I've quit again for 3 months. But I'm over in Thanksgiving with this family I get along with great, but I make an excuse. I say, I got a client, got an emergency, got to go back to Atlanta, don't have a client. I got $300 out of the ATM we couldn't afford. And all the way driving back from Birmingham, I was going, don't think about what you're doing. Don't. La, 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 la. Anybody ever done that? Don't think about what you're doing. And I drove to the Mardi Gras, it was a strip joint, and then went to Cheshire Bridge Road where they had a massage parlor there, and about 4 or 5 days later I had 105 degree temperature. And when it broke, some very strange things started happening with my body, and I was passing gas and debris when I urinated. And I, this was December, and in 2 months later, I went to the doctor. Anybody else here into wishful thinking? And just wishing it would go away? What I had, what I thought I had was some sexually transmitted disease. When I finally went to that doctor, I wouldn't pee in a cup because I had to drink alcohol just to get there. Now I'm drinking solid. There's no gap. And, well, it's not a sexually transmitted disease. I was almost okay with that. I just didn't want them to know that I drank because that was my solution. See, if I'm an alcoholic, alcohol is not my problem. Alcohol is my solution. And alcohol relieves the symptoms of alcoholism. Drugs relieve the symptoms of addiction. If they didn't, we wouldn't use them. So, by May, I finally, my wife, she's saying, there's something wrong with you, you know. And I finally told the doctor what was going on. And the doctor said, oh, you're self-medicating. I am so grateful of these kind people in the healthcare profession. And I know some of you are in there and have done that. And I am so grateful. And I try and do whatever I can to help keep these people informed about what AA is and what it's not and what they can do and what they can't do. Later on, that same doctor, once I was in recovery, I was in a meeting over at Burn Hickory, came out the door, and he was coming out of an Al-Anon meeting across the way. And I got to talk to him about his son and his son's addiction. I got to return the favor. Wow. Who would have planned that? You think I could have planned that? Man. So anyway, July, my wife gives me an ultimatum letter. She says, I don't know what's wrong with you. We may lose the house, and if we do, you may not be invited to the next one. You know? And so on the morning of August the 9th of 2004, I had a little bit of vodka, Barton vodka, and had some cigarettes. I'd been smoking cigarettes for 8 to 10 years, and my wife didn't know it. Sometimes I'd hang my head out the bathroom window smoking a cigarette. You know, one of the great questions for an alcoholic is, what would a grown-up do? Isn't it? I was doing back what I did when I was 12 years old. We used to sneak out at night, you know, in the neighborhood. Man. So, anyway, I decided to quit. And I did. I quit for 2 days. And on Thursday, about 3 o'clock in the morning, August the 12th, I just smoked a cigarette hanging out the bathroom window. My wife's sleeping on the couch. She's drinking wine just to get herself to sleep. And I said the three-word prayer of an atheist. And I said, I need help. And something happened. I have not had the obsession to drink since that time. And I got tired of lying. It was like keeping the plate spinning on the old Ed Sullivan show. That'll really date me. But just keeping those plates spinning with all those lies, you know. And I said, because I had made a promise. I told her that I'd made an appointment with Kaiser Permanente's behavioral services, but I hadn't made the appointment. And I'm sitting there going, how am I going to get out of this one? I said, don't lie, you know. Well, what am I going to quit lying about? How about everything? So I got up that morning, got my daughter off to school, woke my wife up on the couch and told her I've been a son of a bitch. By the way, this is not in the book. I didn't know about the book, except I looked up AA online. It had God in it. By this time, I was a confirmed atheist. And so it couldn't be for me. But I could do this behavioral services thing, you know. So I called him up. By the way, I didn't tell her about the cigarettes, but I quit smoking that day. I've not smoked since. Because it was a lie. Now, I told her about it the next Tuesday. See, her dad's a cancer surgeon. She hated smoking. Just hated it. So I called up Kaiser, and they said, we can see you on the 31st. I said, I don't think you understand. I'm drinking a fifth of vodka a day, and I need some help. And they said, we'll call you back. I made an appointment for the what somebody called the tuba thing that was still going on. And that, by the way, turned out to be diverticulitis. And the only thing that confused the doctors is that I wasn't dead. I had three fistulas going between my colon and my bladder. And they had sealed up so that none of that stuff was getting into the cavity. And in January of 2005, I had that removed. By the way, Raymond, who comes in here, Raymond was in that Kaiser Permanente treatment with me back in 2004. And he came in 2005 to the hospital. By the way, they hit a dog and put about $500 damage on their car on the way over. But I really appreciate it. He's a guy who shows up. He really is. And a lot of people showed up. The guy who gave us that ending to the meeting, you know, he showed up. You see, I went into Kaiser. They made an appointment for me on that following Tuesday. I had a panic attacks in filling out forms. I don't know. I suffer from these. I even had trouble sometimes slicing a tomato by myself in my house, hands shaking and doing all of that. And my wife said, should I go with you? I said, no, I need to do this. And I got in there, but I forgot about the 14 pages of forms. And so I just started filling them out, my hands shaking, and I just, dang, just like that. And I went through the fear. That's what I have to do. I have to go through the fear. I like this guy, was a sponsor, it was Owen Sponsors, I think, down in Texas. And somebody asked him as he was dying of cancer, do you have any amends you haven't made? He said, no, pretty well made all those amends. He said, the only regret I have is all those times in my life when fear kept me from doing what I should have done. And so I have to go through the fear today. Sometimes I still get them. I get nervous every time I come up here to speak, and I've spoken a lot of times. And I think it's because I care. I think it's because I care. I care about you today. So I went and attended on the Wednesday, started going as outpatient, and they had Friday go to an AA meeting. And by the way, it was 8111. I got our guest here from 8111. And I just finally went, fine, you know? I was at that point, I was out of plans. I remember when I'd asked the talked to the psychiatrist after that, filling out the forms, and I told her everything. She said, anything else? I said, well, I had this fear of filling out forms, but you guys cured that in one sitting. So then they sent me down to the behavioral services, and I filled out another 14 pages of forms. And I went to a guy in the counselor there, and I looked up, and he said, anything else? And I said, well, I have a problem with this God thing. He said, you were reading the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, which I was doing when I was drinking, which I just think is funny. And he said, you know, in there they talk about natural laws. I said, yeah, I mean, you like gravity? He said, yeah. I said, why don't you treat these principles like natural laws? I still do today. They're very reliable. They don't take it personal. Gravity's not going to take it personal with you. If I do it, if I pay attention to it, it works. And he also had these Buddhist books and all this stuff on the shelf. And okay, so I went to 8111 and I saw the traditions on the wall at 8111. Well, I was doing contracts for HP, when these big, huge contracts. And I saw that and I realized these guys had taken away every excuse I had for not becoming a member. And I looked at it and I said, that could work. So it needed my approval. I called my sister, or she called me right after that meeting. She said, how long are you going to have to go to these AA meetings? I said, for the rest of my life. Where did that come from? I don't know. I want to get into the great blessings. And I want to start off with willingness. It really is the first. I cannot take credit for having the willingness to do this program because I didn't create me. I didn't pick my parents. I don't know. I have no idea. And I'll tell you, I've got this incredible willingness to do this program, and I've found out I cannot give you a thimbleful of it. In fact, all of these great blessings I have right here are not mine to give you. I can demonstrate them. One person said, doctors do not heal. They create the conditions where healing can occur. So in here, we try and create the conditions where these blessings can be received. So willingness, and it is the key that opens the door. And it is a great blessing. The second for me is the freedom from King Alcohol. And all the other freedoms are attached to that. But having had that obsession removed, I tell people who don't drink, I said, if you want to know what it's like to have the obsession to drink, just hold your breath for 5 minutes. You'll change your mind about breathing. That's what it's like. You guys know it. That feeling that just says, this idea is I get restless, irritable, and discontent, and I will change my mind about quitting drinking if I get restless enough. Clancy once said that the mind, when faced with sufficient conflict, will alter its view of reality in order to resolve the conflict. So it talks about, and Bill talks about, we had to get down to causes and conditions. Really, we start addressing the conditions where that occurs, and they're the conditions in my mind. The third one is awareness. I'm also the guy who's lost about 3 teacups by leaving them on top of my car, so I want you to understand, I don't do any of these perfectly. These are things that I've gotten in some measure. But awareness, I think, is one of the most amazing things to be. I think the steps take away all the things I thought I had to think about. You look at the fourth step, my resentments. I have to think about those because those are the shields. They're protecting me, Scotty. And they turned out to be bars that were encaging me in a prison. And I had to become aware. I had to take a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself so I could become aware of how to look at my own thinking while it's going on. Just like I can listen to a talk after I do it. I can begin to watch it in real time as it happens. The fears. Self-reliance failed us. And then that slips away. And I become just to rely on these principles. Rely on these traditions and these steps. And if I'm relying on them, then the fear goes away. Manipulating other people as a means to an end. They call it the sex inventory. But it is about manipulation. And Bill says we can treat all of our character defects the way we do sex. I love that. We can use that same inventory for that. Talk about when I tell people all these things I've been sneaking around about in the fifth step, I remove that. I don't have the secret. When I go and make the amends, I don't have that on my plate anymore. And what's left? What's left is who I am between my thoughts. What's left is who I am between my feelings. What's left is, what is it about me that's unchanged since my earliest memories? You see, I have this movie screen between my ears that's all these memories and thoughts and smells and sounds and attitudes and stories. But there's something in there watching it. Deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It is only there where He may be found. And I think that's what awakens in this program. By a process of subtraction, not addition. And with that awareness comes number 4 for me, which is appreciation. I can appreciate you today rather than finding out what's wrong with you or doing what I called attack listening. I probably do not listen enough. I know that's one thing for me that I know. But when I can begin to appreciate you, but also appreciate the world. Somebody, we were driving down to Macon doing some of the service work in AA. He said, look at all this trash on the side of the road. And I said, it's wonderful, isn't it? I said, what do you mean? He said, we live in a world where we got all this stuff and we got enough of it, that we can throw it away if we have to. I can learn to appreciate and look for what's good in anything, and I think that's called love. The Greek definition of love is look for the good. I don't think they ever erected a statue to a critic in the history of mankind. And yet I thought it was one of my duties to point out and be, you know, I thought it was one of my character assets. If anything went wrong in those projects at work, I would be one of the first ones to be able to figure out why it wasn't my fault. Somebody else is that one in their trick, huh? And I developed that because it worked for me. All of these things, the character defects that I had, all of them got developed because they worked at one time. But appreciation. Number five is wisdom. And this is not a trait that I claim that I have, but something that's been given to me. And we talk about it in the Serenity Prayer. And it's somehow being able to listen to what somebody's telling me, to pay attention to them, to appreciate where they're at, and being able to share an experience that I have that might help them out. I like what Father Joseph Martin said. He said, the best advice I can give you is don't give any advice. If I don't have experience, I really don't know what the hell I'm talking about. In fact, I've given people advice before, and you know they never really do it the way I think they should do it. And the other one, and also I cannot know enough about your life and your circumstances to give you advice. I was giving a guy advice on handling his girlfriend, and later on I found that he was married. And I guess he didn't think it was important, you know. But I literally cannot know what it's like to be you. I can have a story in my mind that I think I know what it's like to be you. And this lady, she said, the universe is not composed of atoms, it's composed of stories. See, everything I know about the universe is a story, except one thing. I am. And that is astonishing. That there's something here that can experience all these stories. And what do we learn to do in the steps? Step one, change the story. Step two, change the story. Step three, really change the story. What I had to do coming in here is somebody said, why don't you just act as if there is a God and see what happens? There's something bizarre going on here, folks. I don't know what it is, but there's a strange interconnectedness amongst us all. And I stopped just about right there. Anything else for me is a theory. But I find the guy, that whatever this thing is extremely reliable and has a wonderful sense of humor. Number six is energy. I have an amazing amount of energy. I don't know what, because they tell us we're not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to run the whole show. And as a result, on page on 88, it tells me I'm more efficient because I began to realize what are the right things I should be doing and not focus so much on doing things right. Because I'd get so much into perfection about doing something right, I'd be doing the wrong thing, but I'd be doing a wonderful job of it. And so number eight, and Bill talks about this when he defines sanity, is proportion. It used to be my problems, rest of the universe, little spot, you know. Why can't it be universe, big, my situations, small? Because they really are. When this program taught me how to get back into proportion. And number nine, wholesome life. When I was sneaking around and you heard all of that, that was not a wholesome life. I can't define it any more than that except to see you. But let me tell you the other thing, my greatest, you know, these blessings is you. This collective we. And when I really look at this, he says in that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. And anonymity means without name. To come to the realization that I do not exist in the way that I thought I existed. That where I end and you begin is very vague. I did not create the English language. I did not make my clothes, did not make the car. I did these concepts that I'm throwing to you, these were gifts. This is not something I can take credit for. And I can't give it to you. I wish in my heart I could. I've tried. But when somebody's willing, I can't get them drunk. And when somebody's not willing, I can't get them sober. So, I will finish up with where I started. And finally, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the principle of anonymity has an immense spiritual significance. It reminds us that we are to place principles before personalities, that we're actually to practice a genuine humility. This to the end, that our great blessings may never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of Him who presides over us all. Thank you.